Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back as we continue making our way through our favorite 100 movies of all time. And we are officially into the 50s. That's right. We are into the 50s. I can't believe it either. Number 59 coming in today with John's Call Me By Your Name. And mine was Fargo, but John has Fargo higher up. So we're talking The Long Goodbye, the Elliot Gould, Robert Altman movie, which is a chaotic nightmare mess of a movie. Can't wait to talk about that one. Call Me By Your Name, much more recent, 2017, Long Goodbye, 1973. John, we're obviously going to start with The Long Goodbye. I don't think it was a very, I don't think it's a very popular movie at this point. I don't think it's really stood the test of time necessarily. I think it stood the test of time. There's no doubt about that. I mean, in terms of like people actually seeking this movie out, I don't think so. In terms of Robert Altman movies, just in general, obviously MASH is incredibly popular, but it's more popular because of the TV show than because of the movie. Mm-hmm. What was it like sitting down and watching Long Goodbye for the first time here? And how did I do picking a movie to go against Fargo?
Well, The Long Goodbye had actually been on my radar a little bit because like I've been looking into Noirvember because that's a thing that film viewers do is watch noir films in November. So it had made its way on my list. And I looked at our list of movies. I'm like, well, I can't watch it until we have to talk about it. So I was glad to finally get to it. And it's a good movie. It's a really enjoyable movie. I really like the fact that it takes what you know about a noir film and just kind of turns it on its head. That's what's so fun about this is it's not your typical noir film. It's a very atypical noir film. And that makes it so fun to watch when you're watching a bunch of other films.
Well, you know what it is? It's like so many noirs, everybody has the answer for everything. Boom, 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 boom. You get mixed in, but everybody's got the answer for everything. I think about Double Indemnity, which is coming up on my list pretty soon here. One of my all-time favorites. Like, that's what we're used to, the smooth-talking Private Eye. And this Philip Marlowe is definitely smooth-talking, but not smooth-talking in the way that we're used to. He's a mess. He's a chain-smoking, drunk mess the entire movie. And this is like, in my opinion, this is the better version of Inherent Vice. You know, Inherent Vice came out and tried to do this sloppy, all-over-the-place kind of movie, getting into like the porn industry and all that. And it just didn't hit it the way that The Long Goodbye does. There's something about the direction that Altman does in this movie where I feel like I know Philip Marlowe's character so well, but I always feel like I'm looking at it from a distance. We talked about this with La Notte, Antonioni's film, where so many shots are through glass, are through mirrors, are through something weird. This movie does all of that. It always feels like you're not really looking at people dead on. You're never looking at people's faces. You're never getting close-ups on faces. It feels like you're like almost like watching a play take place. And it makes it a very uncomfortable movie, and it makes you feel like kind of like you're not really in it, even though you're like you're an outsider who's just kind of just intruding on what's taking place. It's such an interesting decision, and so many stylistic choices made in this movie that I sit there and I'm like, what was Altman thinking when he was doing that? Because this could have ultimately just failed miserably on all accounts. But I mean, that, I guess that's Altman in a nutshell, is every one of his movies could have been an absolute disaster. And more often than not, they weren't.
Yeah. It does have that kind of like ethereal feel to it where you're just kind of like hovering behind Marlowe the entire time. And I think it's just, it comes down to the way that Altman sets up Marlowe in the very opening of this film, because usually in a noir film, we have that suave PI sitting in his office and then someone comes in. But in this case, we have Marlowe waking up to his cat wanting cat food. And it just establishes so much. You understand everything about Marlowe in that opening scene. And it gets to the point where he's in the grocery store and he's like talking to the clerk about different cat foods. He's like, what, do you not have a cat? And he's like, no, I have a girlfriend.
Yeah.
And like, it's at that point that you just realize Altman's trying to tell you Marlowe is the loneliest man alive.
Yeah. He's got his cat. He lives across the street from these weird, or across the hall from these weird hippie, half nudists, whatever. And his one friend comes and asks him for a favor, and he says, sure, I'll do it. And I think that's what's so powerful about the ending of this movie, to jump all the way to there. Mm-hmm. What's so powerful about the ending of this movie is it really was his only friend. And yep. that's why he takes it so personally. You can see the relief on his face as he's leaving, when he's walking down the street. He's so happy he just killed this guy. But his heart was broken. He really went out on a limb for this guy. His whole life got turned upside down because of this guy. He did all these things for this guy because it really was his only friend. All to just find out, like, no, man, I was using you, and you were the perfect person to use. And what I love about the end of this movie is there's no real discussion. He just says, yeah, whatever, and just shoots him. And that's it. Mm-hmm. It's over. Done. It's so quick. It's simple, but it tells you everything about, like you're saying, about Philip Marlowe's character in this. He's a loner. He's lonely. He gets sucked into this, and the whole time he just wants to keep thinking, no, he wouldn't kill his wife. He didn't kill his wife. He didn't kill his wife. He didn't kill his. And then when he realizes, he says, you know what? What a monster. And I'm going to go do the right thing now and make sure that you suffer for it. It's just, it's a great movie. And it's, I love how all the B storyline and the C storyline and the D story, how they all just interweave, and they really don't have anything to do with anything. That's the best. That I love when that happens to film noirs. And The Long Goodbye is some of the best at it, where really Philip Marlowe's aimlessly walking around for 2 hours. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, that's why I put it at a 3.5 instead of a 4, because it didn't quite get there for me, because it did feel like Philip Marlowe aimlessly walking around for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Because there are some points where it's like, wait, why is this happening now? Because those B and C storylines, they kind of just like pile on a little bit much in mm-hmm. this film for me, I felt. And because we have all that like gang stuff going on, and how that's relating to everything, and you're kind of pieced together exactly what happened to the man and his wife. Mm-hmm. But it got a little confusing for me for a little while. I'm not going to lie.
No, and the first time I watched this, I'd probably put it at like a 3, 3.5. But now I've seen it probably like 3 or 4 yeah. times, and it just keeps moving up the list for me. Because once you know where it's going, you just appreciate what Altman is choosing to do from beginning yes. to end. Every decision he makes, Elliot Gould, look, there's been some classic Private Eyes. People don't talk about Elliot Gould as a great Private Eye, and they should, because his performance in this movie is unreal. I mean, he is all over the freaking place, but he's so phenomenal at what he's doing with this just like sloppy, still good looking, screwed guy. He's just screwed. And the more that you watch this movie, it is definitely a growing movie. It'll grow on you. It'll grow. Because you start to appreciate the Sterling Hayden storyline a lot more. This writer who's just an alcoholic, you think that he really did do mm-hmm. what happened. Because Terry, the first time you watch this movie, almost gets lost on you because you're not expecting him to come back. You just think he's yeah. dead. Okay, that's it. And then when he does come back, it's almost like, well, wait a second. What was he doing? You got to piece it together. When you know exactly what happened, man, you're waiting for that ending. You're like, oh, the way he builds it to that ending, it's so phenomenally well done. All the relationships that Marlowe has to go through, all of this, you know, as the loner, now he has to go out and go to these parties and do all this stuff and have to interact with these people and interact with these other loners who are trying to find their way through, to watch him go through all of that. Just to kind of be like, yeah, nothing happened. None of this mattered. It's pretty devastating, and it makes for just such a powerful ending that is much more appreciated the second, third, fourth time you watch it.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, because that ending is kind of just out there. It is not what you expected, how you expect the film to end the first time you're watching it. Mm-hmm. It feels very earned at the same time, though. Mm-hmm. You feel like, oh, this is great. Like, there's a conspiracy on the conspiracy on the conspiracy in this, mm-hmm. which is really how film noirs operate. Mm-hmm. And just to have, like you said, with that final scene where they don't really talk it out, you get just enough information to understand what happened and how this is happening. And you just have Marlowe going back to being alone.
Mm-hmm. While he's walking past whatever her name is, Carr. And she's in the car and she's like, oh no, what did he just do? And he just keeps walking, doesn't even acknowledge her.
It's great. Haunting. It's hauntingly beautiful is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and even like when he, right before he shoots Terry, he says, yeah, no big deal. Just, you know, I lost my cat too. And he just shoots him because it's like, now that he lost his cat, what does he have? He doesn't have anything. He has nothing. We don't see him interact with anybody outside of the people who are going on in the mystery. Now, that might seem like, well, yeah, it's a film noir, but that's not normally what happens. Normally, he's got a partner. He's got somebody he can work with and shoot ideas of. Everybody who Philip Marlowe interacts with in this movie, except for Terry at the very beginning, is somebody who is trying to get something from him. That is not the case in every film noir. In Double Indemnity, he's got Edward G. Robinson. In Chinatown, he's got his partner. In The Maltese Falcon, he's got his partner. There's always somebody else that this person can bounce off of, no matter who it is. And this movie gives Philip Marlowe absolutely no one. I mean, even the guy, the grocer, is somebody who comes back in at another time. And it's like, oh, I'm just excited to be able to talk to this guy. Because the grocer is like almost like his friend now, because they're buddy buddy. And oh, you helped me find this. And oh, I heard why are you in here? Oh, because I did something with my girl. It's just like that when that's who he's going to. He's got a cat and he's got that guy. It doesn't get any worse.
No, but at the same time, he's still content with the loneliness too. And I think that's really what the ending is getting at, is that contentment with and that acceptance of the loneliness and knowing that's where he is at and it's where he's always going to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And private, I mean, film noirs in general are normally pretty lonely people. Like they focus on pretty lonely people because that's why they're getting into this seedy underbelly and like, why are they willing to put their lives on the line and whatever and blah, blah, blah. But this one, yeah, this one just has a different feel than a lot of the others. You know, he's not chasing after some girl, like some love, like long lost love. There's not a femme fatale. Yes, there is a femme fatale in this movie, but it's not the same way that the other femme fatales normally come up. Like he is not, Sterling Hayden's wife is a femme fatale. However, they never really have a chance. There's never a shot in hell for the two of them. And that's made pretty clear early on in the movie. And you still think that something's going to happen, but it's made pretty evident. And so then you sit there and you wonder, okay, well, what's the love interest in this movie? Or how is, like, there is none. He does it. He's just keeping everything at a distance the entire time. And at the end of the day, like, you know, most film noirs are very focused on what's the mystery and all. This is kind of a character study of just a lonely guy in a profession that's dying.
Yeah, and he's just so, he just seems so inconvenienced by everything. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like, yes, he's doing this because he has to, because it's his job and everything. Uh-huh. But every action that Marlowe takes in the movie feels like an inconvenience. Like, he'd rather just be, like, sitting at home smoking and hanging out with his cat.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, the whole thing with Verringer and all of that, like he's going through the motions. He's doing what he's supposed to do as a private investigator who's investigating. He's doing everything he's supposed to do. But like ultimately it seems like he just wants to get back at society. It seems like, you know, and you think you see that a lot in like these early 70s, late 60s movies. It's a very like anti-establishment time in American history. And it seems like Philip Marlowe is just embodying that whole, like, he can't stand the cops. The cop, like, screw that. Oh, Terry killed himself anyway, so we don't have to worry about it anymore. He can't stand, you know, the doctors. And what are they doing to this poor writer, this writer who just wants to go out and live his life. And this doctor is holding him back. When in reality, the writer's an asshole who is holding out $5,000 or whatever it is. He's a drunk. He's crazy. He's doing all this insane stuff. You see this, though, play out. It's like he wants to be anti-establishment and actually keeps going back to the establishment. At the end of the movie, it's, I'm going to kill this guy because you did what was wrong. You were wrong, and I don't care who you are. I'm going to make sure that you pay for doing the wrong thing. It's a very establishment mindset, not like, you know, but the whole movie, it seems like it's battling these two things. This, he's living across the hall from these women that he's almost bored by. You know, where like all the other guys who keep coming up, they're like, oh, my God, what's, oh, wow, what am I looking at? All this amazing stuff. he's almost bored by it. Like, who cares? So it's this weird fight that's going on between these two ideas that were really going on in the late 60s and early 70s. And that's your backdrop. This isn't your 1940 smoky LA. Yes, this is a very smoky movie, but this is kind of that, it has like that pothead feel to it, even though he's smoking cigarettes, but it has a pothead feel to it more so than those other ones where it was very suave. This doesn't feel like a suave movie, even though this Philip Marlowe is still a very cool guy.
Yeah, and the anti-establishment aspect of it really falls into the fact of like how hostile he is towards the police, right? Mm-hmm. Where even though he's completely innocent, has nothing to say, really, he's just so apprehensive to them. And you have to imagine that that's probably a very common sentiment among actual PIs when mm-hmm. it comes to the police and like them getting involved and in the way and everything. But the fact that he's just so antagonistic towards them, and the fact that they're really shown in a terrible light in this movie of just mm-hmm. like beating him up for no reason all the time. Like that entire sequence when he's in jail and everything, and that we're seeing is just Marlowe being abused by the police.
Well, and it's taking it to that next level, because in the 40s noirs, you would see a lot of people, you know, the cops would always be kind of like on their trail or something like that would be going on, but they would never go to this extreme. It was always still like, well, they're still straight edge. They're still doing like, this was at the time. I mean, a year before this, we had The Godfather come out where Sterling Hayden beats the crap out of Michael Corleone. So like you're seeing like this, okay, police brutality starting to become something that's happening in movies. And this movie's taking it to that extreme that we never saw in the film noirs of the 40s and even the early 50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it just makes the film so much, it gives the film a lot more longevity than it might have had otherwise. Mm-hmm. And because it feels more relatable, it feels more realistic. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really necessary in a film noir, because you kind of have to lean in one way or the other, right? We talked about all these neo-noirs that kind of lean the other way, where it's so unrealistic that it really rules you in. But you need that sense of realism in a noir otherwise, so that it brings you in that way. And when you have a noir plot, because noir plots are convoluted, they're all over the place, and they're kind of hard to follow sometimes, you need that sense of realism then to draw people in if you're not going for the fantastical side of the noir.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then we have Steve here who comes in with, he's the only one who smokes in the movie. And I know that Steve loves this movie. Steve's got this in his top 100. He was the other psycho who did the top 100 list with me, John. So you can thank him for being part of the reason why we're even doing this in the first place. But he has the long goodbye in his top 100. Where does he have it at? I'm trying to look it up here. 55. So right around where we're actually talking about it right here. But he's the only one who smokes in the movie. I did not realize that. That's also insane, though, because that's one, it's such a great characterization. But two, this movie is like looking through fog. I mean, there is so much smoke in this movie. It is unbelievable. Like, you can barely make out what's happening in half the rooms while this is going on. It's crazy that that's all coming from just one poor man's lungs. Philip Marlowe probably didn't live very long, if I had to guess. But that's just an interesting characterization and an interesting choice by Altman to pretty much say, you're going to be the only one who's going to do this. You know, in a movie where pretty much if you go back and watch a lot of these older ones, everybody smokes. Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think even in Chinatown, which came out the year after, everybody's smoking in that movie. It's not just one person smoking. But also, what surface can he not light up a cigarette on, John? Can you name one? It seems like he could probably light a cigarette on water at that point.
Oh, probably.
He just needs
enough tension, surface tension, right?
That's all he needs. I mean, he was finding a way. That's the part that cracks me up about this movie is like, this guy's so disorganized that he's got the matches, but he's just got to find something to light it on the entire movie. And you just see the scratch marks and everything. I don't know. It's just so over the top. It's so over the top. It's so stylized. And like Raymond Chandler, that's the deal with Raymond Chandler, like his old Philip Marlowe thing, the big sleep, all of that. That's what it's all about. It's all about just being overly stylized. And when you go and you look at, like The Big Sleep, this is a movie where half of that story is nonsense, half of that story matters, but the movie itself is phenomenal just because of how freaking cool it looks. You know, but that's Raymond Chandler in general. He's if you've never read a Raymond Chandler book, go read a Raymond Chandler book, because man, his sentences are like five words long every time, but that's just how he writes. And it's just so in your face and over the top.
No, and it is what this film does well. And like, we haven't even gone into the bulk of this film yet, where we've kind of talked about like the bookends of it, as those are, I think, two of the most important scenes in the entire movie, but we have the actual like case itself. And what I really loved about this film was how our inciting incident wasn't some woman coming and being like, oh my God, this is the case. Yes, that does happen eventually. But our real inciting incident is these two cops show up at Marlowe's apartment accusing him of assisting his best friend in murdering his wife.
Yeah, it's the fact that he's actually implicated. Normally, we'll see like the person kind of, you know, the cop starts getting dirty or whatever, and then, you know, he makes it so that he can be implicated later on. That's normally a end of act two going into act three moment.
Yeah.
In this movie, it's the first thing. It's you did this, so now we think it's you. We're going to bring you in for questioning. That's a different take on this genre for sure. And then we see, you know, the story really start to unfold, and it gets not more basic, but it gets more into like your tropes of film noirs, where it's, I need you to look into this. It just all also happens to be taking place in the same area as where Terry was. And all of these stories are actually interconnected and working together. I mean, it is a very interesting plot. It's just when you actually sit down and think about the plot, nothing really happens in this movie. There's really not much that is revealed or that goes on or anything like that. It is all about just Marlowe's journey. It is about Marlowe's journey and the weird people that he just meets along the way.
Yeah, and it kind of does have like this weird, like, I'm just thinking of like Verringer's complex and everything, where it's a weird complex, and like it almost has this like 60s, like it almost has like a Star Trek vibe, and it kind of feels otherworldly the way it's presented in this film. And I just think that's so interesting, because that's just what Marlowe's doing when he's coming and he's communicating with all of these people and actually interacting with people. Is he's stepping out of his world of like his apartment with his cat. He's stepping out of it and like in this foreign world where he's interacting with people all the time. He's going to parties and stuff. It's just a great contrast in the film that really emphasizes a lot of the themes.
Yeah. Yeah, and you said something earlier, and I can't remember what it was, but it was something I wanted to keep go back to. So it was right before you also said getting into the plot of it. But I always love a like Henry Gibson's type character in this, where they make it seem like he's going to be a shady doctor. Now, Henry Gibson is also in Magnolia and plays a great role in Magnolia, one of the weirder parts of Magnolia, which is a weird movie anyway. But I love that they make it seem like he's going to be some crazy quack doctor, because that's another thing that people were fearful of in the 60s and 70s, was like, this doctor is just going to brainwash you and all that. I mean, we see Cuckoo's Nest come out 2 years later. This is what we were watching. And the fact that he really isn't, he just wants to get paid and be left alone. It's like these twists that aren't really twists, because we're looking into it more as if we're watching any other film noir. And it's almost like Philip Marlowe in this, is viewing this as if he had watched every other film noir.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this guy's up to something. Something fishy is going on here. That just feels like what we're getting at. And then it very rarely is what we actually end up getting at in this movie. And, you know, pretty much everybody ends up being what they were supposed to be at face value, with the exception of the people who he ends up getting closest with, which is Wade's wife and Terry. Those are the two that actually aren't doing what they're trying to do at face value. Everybody else is very face value. What they're revealing to Marlowe, and those are the ones that he's more worried about. Whereas everybody else, the two who are lying to him, are the two that he's not even really thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just the construction of this film with its red herrings, and it's a film that knows people understand how it should unfold.
Yeah,
and
you have to with a film noir at this point.
Exactly. And that's what makes it so good, is because it's just when films can play with your expectations and subvert them in a positive way, it does help make them more impactful. And that's why we can talk about this movie so many years later.
Yeah. Yeah, we're coming up on 50 years later, which is insane. So this came out the same year as The Exorcist and The Sting. I don't know if it got any Oscar nominations. I really didn't look into it. But the score, also an awesome score. I love the sloppy long goodbye song that plays a couple different versions of it throughout. It just all adds to that feel. This is such a feel movie. It's such a setting tone movie. It's a very hard type of movie to pull off. It really is, because you're keeping us away from the protagonist. You're keeping us confused. And you're not necessarily, this movie's incredibly cool and it looks really cool, but it's not like oh, look how colorful and everything's so perfect. It's a mess. It's a sloppy movie. And that's a hard thing to pull off sometimes, because it just unsettles audiences. It unsettles people in general.
Yeah, but that's why it keeps bringing people like us to it as well.
Well, yeah, I hope. You know, that's all we can hope for as it keeps rolling along. It was nominated for 0 Oscars, so that answered my question. There you go. Not surprised, although Elliot Gould, man, and Sterling Hayden, I'm pretty surprised that neither one of them got anything for it. Because Sterling Hayden's also pretty freaking wild in this movie.
Yeah.
Pretty wild.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have anything else you want to say about The Long Goodbye, John? No? All right. No. What was the best? I know you had a slow week. What was the best thing you watched?
I did have a slow week. I literally, this week had like a lot of like TV shows release and everything. So like I spent my weekend watching Cowboy Bebop. And like I still haven't even got to the Wheel of Time yet. But
that means nothing to me.
I watched 2 movies today. And one of them was just the stage production of The Newsies. So I guess by default, I have to go with Tick, Tick, Boom, which was the Jonathan Larson musical movie adaptation that Lin-Manuel Miranda directed that released on Netflix. It was entertaining. It's a good musical. I'm not a big Larson fan. Rent's not my favorite musical. I really don't like the music of Rent. This one felt a little more natural, but I'm not a big fan of the way like the narrative structure of this film as much, because Larson really focused a lot on narration in his musicals. So that always feels a little iffy, but it was a good adaptation. Andrew Garfield's phenomenal in it. And it's fun. It's fun. The music's really good.
So you don't like Rent. Do you like Lease? Do you remember that? You know what I'm talking about, right?
No.
The Team America World Police. The Team America World Police. Yeah. Sorry. That's all I can think about whenever anybody brings up Rent. I literally just get that song stuck in my head and it does not go away. And it's amazing that Team America World Police was ever made. Holy shit.
Yes.
But that's all I can think about with that. So did you ever see In the Heights, or did you not end up watching it yet?
I did see In the Heights. I loved In the Heights when I saw it.
You loved In the Heights. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember if we talked about that one or not. I just feel like Lin-Manuel Miranda's popped up a lot. I didn't even know Tick, Tick, Boom was a thing until I saw it today, and I have not seen In the Heights yet, so that's why I was more curious. I had a busy week, man. I had a busy week. Just in the last 2 days, I watched 6 movies, and right after we're done with this podcast, I'm going to watch Thanksgiving, because it's the day before Thanksgiving, and that's really the only thing you're allowed to do. I watched some really good ones. I'm going to do a quick hop around here, which I always seem like I'm doing at this point. John, you could start doing this too if you want. You know, you have my permission. I feel like, especially when you watch so many good ones that like kind of surprise you. So I'll kind of
I try to mention them.
Yeah, you try to mention. I know this week you only had 2 movies. So one, Broadcast News, that was 1987, nominated for Best Picture. I thought it was going to stink. James L. Brooks movie. Thought it was going to be like super corny 80s schlock. It's actually a really like entertaining look at the news world. Tonally gets a little weird halfway through. Doesn't really know what it wants to be. Holly Hunter has the worst voice. It drives me absolutely nuts. And that's why she wins the Oscar for The Piano, because she doesn't really talk in the movie. But it was way better than I thought it was going to be. And if Albert Brooks wasn't going against Sean Connery in The Untouchables, he probably would have won the Oscar. I watched Nowhere in Africa, which was the 2003 or 2004 foreign language winning movie from the Oscars. It's about Jews during Nazi occupation in Germany who flee before the Nazis actually occupy, and they go to Kenya. It is a beautiful movie. It is so good. It is such a different take on what was going on there. they're just hearing the news. They go to like a Jewish community in Kenya, in Nairobi, I think. It is a very interesting other side of what was going on in during World War II. Like the people who got out and how they were trying to adjust. And it's this wealthy Jewish family who is having a hard time adjusting, not realizing the atrocities that are going on, that dramatic irony. Very good movie. I watched that one. I watched Akira Kurosawa's Ran today, which is his King Lear adaptation. It's
been on my list for so long.
Holy crap, man. So for me, Kurosawa's too slow for me. That's just how it is. So I gave this movie 3.5 stars. If the first hour of the movie was a half hour, this is like a top 10 movie ever. It's ridiculous what he was able to pull off with the action scenes and stuff, with all extras and real people. And it's wild. But anyway, all that leads to the best movie I actually watched this week was The Wind Rises, which is a Ghibli movie. I finally got around to another Ghibli. I only have 3 left, and one of them is Irwig and the Witch, so please pray for me. But The Wind Rises, just like gorgeous, just so relaxing. I felt like I was just like transported into this world. It is just, to me, second best Ghibli movie, hands down, no questions asked, behind only Princess Mononoke. I think it's better than Spirited Away. I highly rate Porco Rosso, which I know most people don't, but Porco Rosso is great because it's a pig who flies a plane. But The Wind Rises is just a great movie about like these dreams. And another one with a lot of dramatic irony of this guy who wants to make beautiful planes. And he's making these beautiful planes right at the onset of World War II, so that these planes can be used to bomb people. It's just like, it's gorgeous. It's a great movie. It is deep. Everything is there. I would say definitely check that one out if you haven't seen it yet. I feel like it's one of the least popular of the Ghibli ones. At least nobody had ever mentioned it to me, but it is really, really good. So there you go. I just listed off a bunch of movies for people to go watch. And I'm sure that some of them, like Nowhere in Africa, Broadcast News, those probably aren't on many people's radars, but definitely check it out. Nowhere in Africa, I bought for like $7 on Blu-ray when Kino Lorber did one of their like 50% off deals or something like that. Great purchase. Definitely a movie I'll be watching again not too long in the future. All that being said, though, John, let's be real. The best movie I watched this week, other than The Long Goodbye, because I love The Long Goodbye, was the movie that you have here, and another movie that for me just grows on me every single time I watch it. Why You Gotta Call Me By Your Name here at number 59?
Call Me By Your Name was one of those movies that I caught up. It was after I came back to civilization from living in Bella Coola. I watched Call Me By Your Name at the recommendation of a friend who's really into these coming-of-age movies. And this is absolutely beautiful. Every aspect of this film is beautiful. It's one of the greatest romance films of all time, in my opinion. It's an incredible coming-of-age story, and like seeing Elio come to terms with his sexuality and understanding everything and having that sexual awakening. And Luca Guadagnino's direction is gorgeous. This is an absolutely beautiful film. Guadagnino doesn't get enough credit for his direction. His 2018 adaptation of Suspiria is also absolutely gorgeous. But this, it feels so good to have this type of film made. Because it wasn't long ago that this type of film would not have been made.
Well, and so, okay, so 2017 was only 4 years ago, about to be 5 years ago for anybody keeping track at home. We barely have any time left in 2021, and that's making me feel old because 2022 is when the 30s hit. But I hate when people talk about Oscar bait. Okay, so and this movie really leads me on that tangent, because Oscar bait are these two dirty words that get thrown around like nothing nowadays. Anytime a period piece is made and it comes out between September and December, it's Oscar bait. It's bad. It's automatically pretentious garbage. Like, that is just what it is viewed as. And there's so many great movies that fall into this Oscar bait type category that aren't Oscar bait. And I guess this really started to take shape in the 90s, even though Oscar bait was a thing long before that. In the 90s, we had movies like The English Patient and Braveheart, and you knew what was going to win. Make an epic, and you're going to win Best Picture. English Patient, Braveheart, Titanic, Gladiator. All of these movies are just going right down the line and winning Best Picture all the time. And so it started to be like, okay, let's make something that's sort of melodramatic and go in your face. And then it became, now how can we make that, but also make it more progressive? And so you sit down and you say, okay, how do we make that more progressive? Well, let's make an Oscar bait movie that is about a young man who is finding out that he's gay in his relationship with, you know, an older guy who's a college student, whatever. When this movie came out, it screamed Oscar bait. It was Timothée Chalamet. People didn't know who it was yet. Armie Hammer was still close enough to, you know, having the Social Network and things like that, even though he's not like an A-list actor. But Michael Stuhlbarg, oh, and now it's going to be set in the 80s and it's going to be in Italy and it's going to look pretty. Here's this director nobody's ever heard of. And the script is written by James Ivory. Yeah. Oh, James Ivory's never been Oscar bait. He's never. No, not once. I'll list off James Ivory movies after I give John a chance to give a rebuttal here. But what I hate about that phrase is this movie had such a negative connotation for so many people coming into it. And it's bullshit because this movie is so good and it just lulls you into that 80s laziness, carefree. These people don't have problems. That's the best part about this movie. They don't have problems. They have nothing to do. They have maids who cook for them. They just go around and swim in the river. The dad looks at photos of archaeology. Like, the mom just sits around and learns different languages. They have no problems. But Timothée Chalamet's character is going through a huge transition in his life. And to be able to make a movie that can be lazy, but also be about something as difficult as coming of age in a time where this wasn't widely accepted, Guadagnino just nailed it. He just nailed it from start to finish. And this movie just makes me want to go live in Northern Italy for 3 months in the summer.
Mm-hmm. And it just has that, he really captured that Northern Italy brightness that comes around with Italy in summer. And you really notice it when we get to the point where they're talking about meeting at midnight. Because you get a really good idea of what time it is for most of the day during that sequence of events. But it's so bright. It's so colorful. And colors are super important in this movie. We'll get to that a little bit later. But it's hard for me, as someone who wasn't really paying attention to the Oscars in 2017 because I couldn't go to a movie theater. Hmm. It's really hard looking at this and thinking this was an Oscar bait movie because of the way that I experience it, but I see that. And a lot of it comes down to there's this performance by Timothée Chalamet, which just makes this movie. Timothée Chalamet and Armie Hammer. Armie Hammer should not be understated for how phenomenal he is in this movie either. No. Despite the fact that, you know, people, Hollywood might be canceling Armie Hammer now, but his performance in this movie is top notch.
And my biggest thing, and as we've moved through this, and my number two movie is American Beauty. I have Kevin Spacey 3 different times on this list.
Yeah.
4 different times because I have 7 as well. The thing is, like, I say this all the time. There's a lot of really bad people in Hollywood. A lot of really, really, really despicable human beings. If you start saying, I'm not going to like this movie or I'm not going to like this because they're a bad person, you're not going to have anything left to be entertained by. Because in all your Avengers movies and all that stuff, there's bad people involved in every single one of those. The problem isn't us watching them. The problem is the people in Hollywood talking about how bad they are, those people, but still hiring them. That's the problem. If those people want to sleep at night and they feel good about themselves, it's on them. So when I sit down, Armie Hammer, he's in the process of being canceled. All that's going on. His performance in this is fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. And not for nothing, Gary Oldman wearing a fat suit should not have won Best Actor over Timothée Chalamet in this movie. Timothée Chalamet is a better performance. However, nobody knew who the heck he was at this point. Therefore, he had no chance in heck of winning it over Gary Oldman, who'd been robbed so many times. He's going against Daniel Day-Lewis, Daniel Kaluuya, and Denzel Washington. Chalamet had no chance. However, Chalamet's career has exploded because of this movie. And, you know, he also came out the same year. He's in Lady Bird the exact same year. He just had this like mysterious, weird thing going on that everybody could just buy into. I what I'm most shocked at is that Guadagnino was not nominated for Best Director this year.
Yes.
That's the one that blows my mind. And I know that this was a very controversial year. This was the same year where Three Billboards wasn't nominated for Best Director. Greta Gerwig and Jordan Peele were both nominated for Best Director. I do not believe that Jordan Peele should have been nominated for Best Director. But obviously there was some social discussion going on at the time. I still think that Guadagnino, the fact that he wasn't even nominated, and this was a year where this type of movie actually could have won. It snuck up on a lot of people, and a lot of people liked it a lot more than they thought they were going to like it. It could have snuck up and actually won this thing, because really, another really weird movie about a sexual relationship that wouldn't have been depicted on film maybe 10 years prior, at least not as beautifully, wins Best Picture, which is The Shape of Water. You know what I mean? So like when you look at this, like Hollywood is – in 2017 is starting to take a few more chances with this, and it's being rewarded. And like Call Me By Your Name might be the one that when you go back and you watch movies from this year over and over and over and over again, this might really be the one that ultimately separates itself from the rest of them. Because Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri was my favorite at the time. I can pretty confident, actually, I think Shape of Water, I haven't seen Shape of Water in so long now, but I loved both of them. I can confidently say I enjoyed Call Me By Your Name more on this rewatch than I enjoyed Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri on that rewatch.
Yeah, I think it's a movie. I really think this movie plays on us in a way that's really unexpected, because it really pulls you into it. It's, I mean, I'm going to say, when I watched it this time, I didn't have subtitles for any of the French. Thankfully, I know enough French to understand what was happening.
Oh, okay. You didn't do it on purpose. I was going to say, all right, big man.
No, I didn't do it on purpose. There was just no subtitles when I was watching it. I was like,
got it.
Fun. But the performances in this film, it almost doesn't matter what's being said, because there's so much subtle subtext in every single scene in this movie. And the acting is so phenomenal in putting it out there so you feel it. The subtleties in Elio's understanding and appreciation for Oliver and how he falls in love with Oliver, it's so beautiful, because it's also contrasted by the starkness of him grabbing his penis. Right? Like, and it has these very abrasive moments, but also these beautiful, subtle moments that Timothy Chalamet is so phenomenal,
yeah,
putting it forward. And it's so great that he's kind of exploding because of this movie and because of Lady Bird, and that we're seeing him, because he's right now, he is by and far the greatest actor of his generation.
Yeah, I mean, and he's still so young. I mean, at the time that this movie was made and all that, he was 22 years old. That's it. Yeah. 22 years old. And you know, when you start going down the line, it's just, a lot of times what ends up happening is these types of actors, they don't get the credit when they should have gotten it. You know, you look at Ryan Gosling with a movie like Half Nelson, or with Blue Valentine or something along those lines. Doesn't get the credit when he should have gotten it. Jesse Eisenberg, back with The Social Network, should have won Best Actor that year. Loses to Colin Firth, who didn't get the credit the year before for Single Man. Like, it's like the Oscars are always trying to play catch up. And the one nice thing for Chalamet is he has just totally caught fire. I mean, people love him. I think him being in this movie, it's so weird, because his rise to fame, he's not like a I don't know what the word is, but he's not like an icon because of his like sex appeal, but he almost is. Like, it's a very weird thing. And because of being in Call Me By Your Name, I feel like that, you know, also brought him really into the LGBT community, where now, like, he's very attracted there, but he's also very attracted in just the straight community. The
traditional ways, yeah.
Yeah. Like, everybody is very attracted to Timothy Chalamet. It's a very interesting place, because has that ever really happened in Hollywood history with an actor? Not with an actress, but with an actor. Has that ever really happened where there's been such crossover with that? And I think that that's helped his career to just like, I mean, it just seems, because he can play any role, and he shows that he is ready to take on any role.
Yeah. And there's even a scene in this movie that kind of focuses on that, when it's the scene where they're going through the slides of the pictures, and they're just talking about the form of body and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's just that, like, you're not seeing, we get those a few cuts to Elio in that scene, but you're like, just Oliver's reaction to the description that the professor's giving and everything. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And like the knowledge that he's thinking of Elio in those moments makes you think of Elio in those moments. Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. and it really does give you that kind of like classic Greek appreciation for the human body.
Yeah, it's definitely leaning into it. This movie has so much subliminal messaging, if that's even the right word, but you know, like subliminal messaging, oh, here it is. And then it puts the thought in your mind. Mm-hmm. This movie is doing that so often. Yeah. I mean, the whole time, like you cringe with him. You feel what he's feeling. You know, when she says, I just don't want you to hurt me, you know, that's exactly what's going to happen later in the movie. And when they're having that realization, you know that what's going through her mind, even though she never says it, which is what is so beautiful about James Ivory's script, is she never says it, but what's going through her mind is all she wants to say is, I just didn't want you to hurt me. And you can remember all these things because every line is just the dialogue that they do choose is so powerful and important, and it just resonates with you, that makes a big difference when you're trying to get the subtext of conversations that happened earlier or later or whatever else is going on. You know, I think about the end when they go to get on the bus and Kiara, she comes up on the bike and she's like, oh no, I missed them. And mm-hmm. you can just see in Armie Hammer's face, he does not give a shit. He doesn't care. But to her, it's so important. And I think that's the difference, though, between Elio's relationship with Marzia, is it does mean something to both of them. They do mm-hmm. have something that they can bond over and connect with and all that. And it's all of this subtext and it's this understanding and this realization and being okay with who you are and you know, everybody else around you in the same boat. And to me, and he wasn't nominated and he's not a very big role in the movie, and it makes sense that maybe he wasn't nominated. But to me, the best scene in this entire movie is just at the end when Michael Stuhlbarg is giving the entire speech to Elio about everything. That is one of the best father-son moments in movie history. Mm-hmm. And every time I watch that scene, I'm just like, man, to sit down and write that when you're James Ivory, and obviously this is based on a book, but when James Ivory sits down and writes that part in the movie, in the screenplay, and then Michael Stuhlbarg starts delivering the lines, you're writing one of the most beautiful like speeches ever written in a movie. And you're doing that 100 years after movies were invented, 150, you know what I mean? What he was able to put into that and what he's able to get across in the subtext and the not subtext, the very like, here's what's on the surface. Here's what I'm saying to you as your father, all of these things. And for him to just be like, you know, I was close to having that once, but I never had what you had. Stuhlbarg just completely gets lost in it. And to me, like that scene to always elevates the movie to me. And I have to remind myself that like, yes, I enjoyed everything before that. And this is a 4-star great movie, but that scene is not what the whole movie is. That scene is just its own special scene that to me makes me say, where do I put this in my top 100? But then the rest of the movie, it's like, okay, it's not there. Like it's not, it's a great movie, but it's not there. But that scene, man, it kills me every time.
Yeah. It's beautiful. And I mean, father-son scenes have always been like a big thing for me in movies. I will always cry during touching father-son scenes. And this is absolutely one of them where it's just like, my God, it's just so beautiful what's being said. And then Stuhlbarg's performance and delivery of it and how, and even on top of that, just like the acceptance that he has for Elio still. And there's no judgment. Like, you know, it's 83, you know, what's happened. Like, you know, Oliver and Elio's relationship is troublesome on many levels to a lot of people at that time of the year or that time of
history.
Yeah. Yeah. And not year.
Definitely also history. In the summer, you know? Yeah. Also in the summer, it bothers them.
But the point, and just to have such a caring father who is looking at the beauty of it really emphasizes the fact that he's this professor of like this of history, and just like has that appreciation for this beauty as he's looking at art all the time, and he's seeing the true art of life in front of him.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's what, you know, it really does come from that place of understanding where it's like, you know, he's looking at sculptures all the time that really were just about, like, there was no judgment in whether you thought the sculpture was beautiful or not. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, humans started to adopt more and more and more and more and more as people just start judging and all that. And yeah, like it's one of those scenes. And I think what makes this movie so good is that Armie Hammer and Timothée Chalamet, when they're together, they're great. But it is those scenes with Marcia, those scenes with the mother, the scenes with Mafalda, the scenes with Michael Stuhlbarg. It's those scenes that elevate this, because you're getting something from all of your side characters. And these don't feel forced in just for the sake of pushing the story forward or getting a point across. Even though that is what's happening here, it still feels like an authentic conversation that would be had, especially when you think about earlier in this movie, he's bringing up to his father and Armie Hammer that he almost had sex with Marzia the night before. Like, when that's coming up, it lets you know that they have this incredibly open relationship. And he goes, well, why didn't you? They have this incredibly open relationship that makes for a scene like this at the end. It's earned. It's not just one of those out of left field, crazy, stupid love, Steve Carell giving a speech at the end of the movie things. It's very much meant to be there with quite a purpose.
Yeah. There's so much setup from these side characters, because they just punctuate everything that's happening and like the feelings Elio's having. Because Elio is far and away our protagonist of the story, and there are some things that are like missed from the book translation into the film. Obviously, there's no male full frontal nudity in the movie, because Chalamet and Hammer both had no male frontal nudities as part of their contracts. And like the author of the book was like, yeah, I kind of wanted that, but I get it.
Yeah.
America, stop being so sensitive about penises. It's okay. The rest of the world doesn't care.
Although Guadagnino did direct this. And I think Guadagnino, if you're Chalamet, it's a harder position than being,
Hammer.
You know, because Chalamet, you're just starting out. You're 22. He's still, you know, his ass is in the movie. So there's that, John.
Yeah.
But I do. Look, I watched The French Dispatch, okay? Not everybody's going to be Lea Seydoux, okay? Yeah. Not everybody's going to be her. There's some, you know, it makes sense. And especially when you're Chalamet and you're just trying to start out, you don't want that to become what people are going to know you for. Now,
I definitely agree with that. But I understand where the concerns about it not being present in there. He's coming from as well
because it's a power thing. It's meant to show power, and it's the whole thing that Emilia Clarke went through with Game of Thrones, where she said, "I'm not doing any more nude things unless it's a power thing." Yeah. And when she burns down the witch's hut or whatever it is, she has another nude scene, and it's like, okay, but that's because now she is like reborn. It's a power thing. Yeah. So you pick and choose your battles there, and I totally understand why the author of the book would have been like, "No, this should be in there because." That's what you know, the sculptures, that's how it is.
There was a sculpture of a penis. Just give us a real penis.
Yeah.
It's okay, we can handle it.
John's gonna get us kicked off of YouTube because unfortunately YouTube's still American, John.
But on top of that, like there's also like some controversy about the fact that you don't see the gay sex scene. Mm-hmm. Like there are people who are controversial about that. It's an artistic move. It's very artistic not to show that scene and to like show it starting. And then we don't get a cut. It's not like we're fading away from it, but we move away from it and we know it's still happening. And that helps justify it a lot more.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, American viewers don't like seeing penis. So.
Well, and you have to think, though. I mean, you have to think with a movie like this, this was kind of a unique thing. It really, since Brokeback Mountain, and I'm probably missing something in here, but Brokeback Mountain came out in 2005. Yeah. Between then and Call Me By Your Name, which was a 12-year span, was there another movie with the subject of a gay couple that had gotten such acclaim like those two movies? And so when you set out to make that movie, you do have to keep a little bit of a, it's like, if we want this to be elevated to Oscar and stuff like that, you still have to give people kind of what they want. And it's the same thing we talked about with The Impossible last week. They had to, like, a lot of people wouldn't watch that movie because it was so grotesque. There's a lot of old people who sit down and vote for the Oscars. A lot of old people who sit down and vote for the Oscars and are not going to be pumped about that. And so you have to think about all of these things. And I think it's, you know, it's one of those things that you're kind of navigating as when you're like a Hollywood producer, when you're trying to make a movie about what shouldn't even be a touchy subject, but about what is a touchy subject. You know what I mean? About what's still a touchy subject in 2017. But I will say that I think the choices Guadagnino made this movie a lot more accessible to a lot more audiences. And I think that was ultimately better for this movie. And I think it was ultimately better for this type of movie getting made more, because there's a lot of people who really love this movie that if you had a conversation, hey, tomorrow's Thanksgiving, who knows what kind of conversations you're going to have, but there's a lot of people who you'd be having a conversation arguing with at Thanksgiving dinner that are going to turn around and surprise you and be like, no, I loved Call Me By Your Name. Like, there was a lot that was going on in this. The other thing that you had to be careful with, even though the ages are obviously what they are, is the fact that in this movie, Chalamet is supposed to be 17 years old. So that's
this is a 7-year age gap in this
movie. It's a 7-year age gap, and it's 17. So it's at that borderline of, is this legal? Is this not legal?
Yeah.
That's also why I think they had to like kind of keep kid gloves on a little bit with this.
Yeah,
I mean, agree. they don't show any of the sex scenes the entire movie. So I think that's important. All of that's happening off screen. Mm-hmm. And it's really giving you more of like, what does the room sound like? What does it feel like? Can you feel like you're in there? And I will say that this movie does do a very good job of hitting you with all five senses, because there are just certain things where you can just feel it. You can just feel this summer and all that. I'm telling you, I'm going to move to Northern Italy, John. You're never going to hear from me.
Oh, okay. But
see ya.
No, it does hit you with all those senses, and it does so very beautifully. And there's like that ever present focus on like the apricot orchard. Mm-hmm. And the use of an apricot later in the film.
That's a peach.
I thought it was an apricot.
That's a peach.
It's okay. At least Oliver doesn't eat it in the movie like he does in the
movie. Oh my God, dude. I think the world would have lost its mind if he would have eaten it in the movie.
But there's all these little things in this film where we get like the apricot discussion when they're talking about the etymology of the word apricot. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, that one got me going. It's a type of conversation that's just like, ooh, that gets me a little hot and bothered having someone discuss etymology, apparently. But then, like, at the end of that conversation, when Elio's just like, yeah, he does this every year. It's like, this is a trap that the professor sets for his students to, like, actually say what they have to see if, like, they're up to snuff. Yeah. And, like, that's beautiful because having a conversation about words puts so much more emphasis on the words being used in the film.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I think it makes you pay more attention to the dialogue. It makes you pay more attention even to the song by, was it Sufjan?
Sufjan Stevens.
Yeah, like even to his song, I mean, Mystery of Love. There's a reason why that caught on so much. It's because like, it's just like you're focused on what's being said in that song. I was really surprised when I looked up earlier though that Guadagnino wasn't nominated and the score wasn't nominated, because the score in this movie is like,
the score isn't original though. The score
is what the problem is. The
score is a bunch of classical pieces. It's a lot of John Adams. It's a bunch of John Adams pieces for the most part, and then like, you know, we have the Bach and the other classical pieces. And stuff
I was going to say, man, that is,
it's because this score takes the Shining approach where it's using pre-composed music to flush it out. But yeah, the score is phenomenal, and there's that emphasis on music and like style of music, and how there's the scene where Elio's playing the piano and he's playing the Bach cantata, and he plays it differently each time, and it's like, I'm playing as if Berlioz was playing this. It's so playful.
Well, in this movie, definitely is pretentious, which is nice. But it's pretentious with a purpose. Like, these are people who would be having these kinds of conversations. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the dinner scene where he gets the bloody nose and they're just arguing about everything. And it's like, oh my God, like, this is what they have to sit around and argue about because they have nothing else. Like, they have nothing else to worry about. So they can be like this. It's purposefully pretentious. Like, this is how these people would talk. I think that that's so important to a movie because this could have been one of those movies where your characters could have had really nothing, like no purpose to the conversations they're having, but it works here.
And the beauty of that too is the fact that, like, despite these people are people who don't, like you said, don't have a care in the world, and it's hard for people to relate to these people. Yet all of these characters feel so relatable at the same time.
Yeah,
like there's just such an emphasis on the humanity of and the humanity of them, and the fact that this is something all of us experience. Like, we all have that experience of falling in love and not knowing how to proceed with it. Mm-hmm. And the emphasis on that part of the film is huge, especially with, like, the mother telling the story of the knight who wondered if it was better to speak or to die.
Yeah. That's actually the slogan for the movie, which I didn't realize. Yeah. Is it better to speak or die?
Yeah. And the conversation about it and the fountain scene, or I guess it's not the fountain scene, but the war memorial scene.
Yeah.
It's the longest take in the entire, or it's the longest shot in the entire film. It's about 4.5 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's so powerful seeing Elio and Oliver have this conversation about, like, Oliver complimenting Elio and saying, you know a lot, like, you know a lot. And Elio just being like, but I don't know about the things that matter. And at that moment, that's that turning point in this film where you, like, you know where everything's going at that point. And it's captured so beautifully with them going their separate ways around the memorial and then meeting up again. It's gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah, Call Me By Your Name is definitely one of those that stand. It's going to stand the test of time for a very long time. It's just an incredibly well-made movie. Guadagnino's got to start doing a little bit more. He's not doing enough, so he's got to get back out there. Got to start working. And I do think that in the end, that's probably going to be the movie that most people talk about from that year. Even though Get Out obviously is a movie that came out that year, that's more popular. But I think from, like, a cinephile standpoint, Call Me By Your Name will be the one that people are talking about 15 years from now as, like, that should have won Best Picture. You know what I mean? I really think that that's where we're going to end up with that.
Yeah. Did you notice that Elio's swim trunk colors correlated with his mood?
Wow.
Or not Elio, not Elio, Oliver. Oliver's
swim Oliver's, trunks. Okay.
That's why we get that montage of Oliver's swim trunks on the spout of the tub.
Oh, yeah.
It's because in the book, it's very clear that Elio has this understanding that the swim trunks correlate with his mood. So we get the green sub swim trunks are when he first, like, when he's playing volleyball and he flirts with Elio there. Mm-hmm. And then the yellow ones, he gets a little more prickly, but he seems a little more cautious but more willing at the same time. It's very interesting to see the use of, like, colors in the wardrobe with the characters.
I didn't notice that, but I will say something I liked about the wardrobe choices is I like that they rewear clothes throughout the movie. So often in movies, people will wear a shirt one time and then they go to something else, unless it's, like, purposeful in Westerns and things like that. Or, like, you know, in Taxi Driver, he's always wearing that jacket. But I do love that, like, they're re-wearing the same t-shirts, the same shorts, the same swim trunks. I think that's a really interesting choice because it's showing that, like, during the summer, you're going to be wearing the same stuff. And it's, we know it's not the same day, but, like, I mean, how many shirts are you wearing in the summer when you were in high school? You're wearing, like, 5 shirts. It's like, whatever, whatever I can get my hands on, I'll wear the same thing over and over again. I don't care. So I like all those little choices. It makes it feel more human. It makes it feel more real. It makes it feel more authentic. And I'm telling you, like, I could smell this room. I could smell this house. I could smell this place. I could feel it. It's just such an all-encompassing experience watching this movie. And, you know, that's why it is where it is. On John's list.
It is. And honestly, it's probably going to be higher next time I make my list because this movie, as you said, it gets better every time you watch it.
It's one that could sneak onto my list at some point in the future. I still only gave it 4 this time, but, like, you know, the more I watch this, the older I get as I start to mature and stop liking movies like Back to the Future and Borat and things like that, This is a movie that could definitely work its way up there and just keep on growing on me every single time I watch it.
Yeah. I mean, we also have, I'm sorry, I'm going
to
keep,
no, keep going, keep going. I need to watch Thanksgiving once you're done. I know that these are kind of the same movie, but
just the Call Me By Your Name aspect of this film.
Yeah.
And like Call Me By Your Name and I'll Call You Mine. It's so beautiful because it's like, it's just this admission of like, you are me and I am you. And it's kind of this unity and it's the beauty of that relationship becoming a thing.
Yeah. And the last shot of this movie is brutal because that's what you're thinking about is like on that phone call when he did the Oliver, or he did the Elio, Oliver. Yeah. Yeah. So like when that happens, and then he just stares at the fire for however long, like that's such a great ending to this movie.
It's one of the most beautiful final shots of a movie ever.
It's so and devastating. Just
having that haunting Sufjan Stevens come up at the same time.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there and the credits are rolling and you're like, I can't turn this off. Yep. I have to watch this through. And you just see like all of the emotion in Timothée Chalamet's face. And yes, he's crying and he's angry, but then he like gets to the point of acceptance and you just see him go through the grief of losing a relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a brutal ending. All for her to just say Elio. Yeah. Thank you, Steve. Thanksgiving's an hour and 6 minutes. I know, but Steve is about to, he was supposed to start at 11. So I guess he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing. John, if you haven't watched Thanksgiving, I know that that's an American holiday, but you should watch Thanksgiving. It is a movie that knows it is atrocious and they set out to make a bad movie and it knows it's bad. That's the important thing to know. And oh my God, is it bad? It's one of the most entertaining movies of all time. The amount of JonBenet Ramsey jokes throughout, it's second to none, John. You'd love it. If you love The Room, which you do, you would love this.
I do.
All right. Next week, we keep on moving through. John's got Donnie Darko from 2001. And then I had Mulholland Drive also from 2001, but John's got that so much higher.
Way higher.
So we're going to talk about Inland Empire, which is a movie I have not watched since high school, and I cannot wait to sit down and watch it again. It is a Lynch movie. It is freaking weird. One of the weirdest movies I've probably ever seen. I remember at the time I said it was the scariest movie I'd ever seen in my life. If you're sitting down and watching this for the first time, be prepared for one of the weirdest movie experiences, weirdest 3 hours you're ever going to experience in your life.
I'm so excited.
Lynch went
home. I'm so excited.
Have you? You've never seen it, right?
I've never seen it, but I'm a massive Lynch fan, so I'm all here for it.
It is wild to say the least. It is wild to say the least, and I cannot wait to watch it, and I'm very excited. It's the first time, like I said, in a very long time. It is bizarre. It is polarizing. I love it, but there are some parts in this movie that you're just going to be like, what the hell? It only made $4 million at the box office too. And it's a 3-hour movie. So yeah. Anyway, that's it. We'll see you all next week. And I'm going to keep trying to watch like 10 movies a day now from here until I have to go back to work. So bye everyone.